Hello. Yes, it is. Okay, what's your first name? It was designed originally to assist ex-victims, but in the past years, because of the massive media interest, because of the amount of publicity we've had to move into different aspects of the problem. We now work with kids currently being abused, stopping that abuse taking place, confronting abusers, supporting families through courts, legal actions, medical actions, psychological actions, and so on, and even to the point now of assisting, advising, and guiding abusers in how to get therapy for them. So in effect, rather than being just a support group, which is what we were first brought into being for, we're now an active group that helps with all aspects of the problem of incest.
Of all the children that are alive in this country now, 1,117,000 of them are likely to be sexually abused by the time they're 15. That's a lot of people, that's a lot of children, a lot of potential adults, that's a lot of abusers.
When we lived with our great-grandfather, there was me and two other sisters, and he went on sexually abusing us for a long time. The only way out of that was when he died, actually. But with him, we believed, we loved him. He was only there to love us back. You know, he wasn't going to do anything to hurt us. So what he was doing wasn't wrong, we didn't think, until it reached a stage where you didn't like what he was doing and you wanted him to stop. And by then, he'd got the emotional blackmail going, where if you tried to stop him, he would tell. We couldn't tell our mum, because if we told mum, she wouldn't believe us. She would think, you know, as Pop said, mum would think we were lying because we'd let it happen for so long. Pop always used to say he wouldn't actually physically hurt us or leave any signs. And again, I didn't know what that meant. And that went on, as I say, up until he died. After he died, Maurice moved in, and I had a baby brother, he was born. And we all lived in the house. Me, my brother and two sisters lived in the parlour, while Mam, Maurice and the baby lived in the living room. Maurice used to come upstairs into the bedroom of a night and just carry on where Pop took off, literally.
The child who's being abused within the family is in the awful situation of losing both parents, effectively. They lose their fathers, where the father is the abuser, because the father ceases to behave like a father, ceases to be a protective adult who considers the children's needs first and foremost. The child also seems to lose the mother because of a terrible dilemma, that if the mother doesn't know what's happening, then there is a feeling that the mother is neglectful, distant, and should know. And if she doesn't know, then she's not a caring mother who's looking after the child properly. That may be the view of the child. The other awful alternative is that she does know. And if she does know and she doesn't do anything about it, then perhaps that means that she wants it to continue, or that she's in agreement. And again, the child is left with the feeling that they're being neglected and not cared for properly. A child in that position is often locked into a position of secrecy for a long period of time, so the abuse goes on for a long time. The child is unable to tell, and may then begin to feel guilty and responsible.
It's an illogical feeling, really. If you're the victim of a crime, you shouldn't feel guilty about being the victim of a crime. You should just feel bloody angry that the person who abused you has abused you and has committed a crime against you. But we're suffering lots of different betrayals. Betrayal of trust by the one person in our life that we should have held in particular esteem and love in a particular sort of way. That's destructive enough. Betrayal by the other parent too, whether they knew or not, is irrelevant. They didn't protect their little child, and little children don't look at the politics as to whether mummy or daddy knew what was going on. They didn't damn well protect her. Then we have a final betrayal, as far as we're concerned. Subject anyone, I don't give a damn who it is, to consistent sexual stimulation, and eventually something's going to occur. And the minute anything occurs within our bodies, and it occurred with me when I was a child, and it confused me, and it made me feel that it was my fault. How can you hate somebody for doing something to you that, damn it all, can be so pleasurable? It is that sort of the part of the problem that's designed to make us effectively take all of the guilt, all of the shame, and all of the blame off of the shoulders of the offender. And he's quite happy because he's finally justified to himself totally why he's doing what he's doing.
Most children are terribly loyal to their families. They don't want to say that something has happened. And, you know, for years we've lived with us in a situation where when a child has told us something of that kind, that daddy's touched me, or my uncle's touched me, or grandpa, or my big brother, or my big sister keeps on, you know, touching my willy or whatever, we've said, oh, that's really all just a make-believe. Children are like that. They want attention. Or children are really, they've got very strong sexual feelings, and they get muddled and confused about them, and they think that people are touching them when it's their wishes. You know, we've got into that sort of way of thinking over the years. But I think now we think that's not fair, really. We must take what children say seriously, because we do know, sadly, that an awful lot more children are used as sexual things, as it were, objects. Children's innate, natural sexuality is used by adults who say, well, look, she's behaving, or he's behaving in such a sexy way, he or she must want to be involved in something sexual with somebody else. And it's only right. Why should they have to wait until they're 12 or 15 or 18 or something like that? Why not now? They seem to be very sexy. And that, of course, is absolutely wrong, because that's use of a child. Children's sexuality is natural. It's part of their growing up, their curiosity, their rudeness, their interest in willies and boobs and all the rest of it. That's a natural, normal part of a children's curiosity, and it's not for adults to, as it were, use it for their own ends and to see it as something which it's not.
All the family members seem to suffer greatly in this situation, and that obviously the child, the victim, is in need of help and psychotherapeutic help. But what we also find is that there is a need for the mother and children to have help to get their relationships sorted out. There's a need for the couple to have help, for the marriage to be sorted out, for the parents to then operate more cooperatively as parents, and then perhaps a need for the offender to have help in his own right, and for the whole family to have help.
What we're talking here about is trying to elicit from someone something that they've done which is, in a way, horrendous. The problem of dealing with it is one's own anger at the person having done it to a child, particularly, which one has to contain. There isn't a set pattern. I mean, every human being is different, and one has to approach it differently. In some people who deny, you have to keep hammering until you get it out of them. Some people who immediately expose what they've done and understand that they've done it and are full of anguish and concern and trying to get it resolved. There isn't a way of saying, you bastard, why did you do it? What we're talking about, one of the tragedies in the situation is that people don't understand that even though a man may abuse his child, male or female, the child still loves the father, and the father still loves the child. There's a confusion that's emerged in it, and one has to protect the child from the father. The child therefore begins to feel guilty because the father has been removed or is under pressure, or there has to be someone present whenever the child is in the presence of the abuser. And the abuser is full of anguish and concern for being guilty, and to rehabilitate a family under those conditions is extremely difficult. What there hasn't been is a long-term investigation into individuals, into families, constantly monitoring, in order to get some sort of result. I mean, this we don't have, and of course, with this government, without any finance to actually go proceed in this without any really deep concern, we're never going to understand this whole problem here, because it's dealt with undercover. Nobody likes to talk about that. Nobody can talk about AIDS and homosexuality, etc., because it's uncomfortable, and this society deals with it by suppressing it. It still suppresses it. It still doesn't want to deal with it.
Children who have been inappropriately sexualized, shall we say, may well be preoccupied with reenacting that experience in their play, in their drawings, in their talk. They may comment on the effects of the sexual involvement rather than describe what actually happened. So a child between 2 and 6 may well say, "Daddy hurt my bottom," or "My brother hurt my willy," or some such thing like that. They'll comment on the effects for them. If they think that an adult is going to be cross with them or react badly towards them for telling, then they're not going to tell. A child, though, is often in a very peculiar dilemma, that if they tell and they are believed, then they have some idea that the consequences of that will be bad, both for themselves and for the family. However, if they tell and they're not believed, then they'll be accused of lying and they'll be punished for telling. So, in a way, they can't win whatever reaction they get, or they fear that they won't be able to win, and so it's better not to say anything. And I think that sums up the paralysis that children, the psychological paralysis that children do suffer when they're in this predicament. Children of 7, right up through to their teens and into adulthood, people don't talk because they fear both being believed and not being believed, and it's better somehow to keep it to yourself.
What we would see as important is the need to listen carefully to the child, the need to obtain a sensitive medical examination, not only to establish whether or not there is evidence that a sexual offence has taken place, but just to establish the child's all right, the child's fit and well. We would also look to consolidate and help the family through a very difficult time when secrets are disclosed and one member of the family, the child, may be very distressed, but in a position, perhaps, of being forced quite inappropriately to take responsibility for a different member of the family being excluded and perhaps imprisoned. It's a time of deep family upset.
I'll damn anybody that places a child into care because she or he is being sexually abused, because effectively what you're doing is punishing a child twice for something that wasn't its fault in the first place. You know, it's relatively easy. Damn it, it's very easy to get an abuser to leave home, to move out, so that the family can recover, if only temporarily. Once you've actually allowed, a mother's actually allowed a child to go into care, it's the devil's own job to get that child back out of care when she realises that she's made a mistake.
Obviously, it's a very, very difficult decision, because to say that a child should not be living with his family, even temporarily, is very distressing to the child and to the family. We feel it's a decision that must be taken by the professionals whose job it is to think about and who have got a responsibility for the protection and care of children in the community. That's social workers, probation officers, general practitioners, paediatricians, psychiatrists, child and family psychiatrists like myself, perhaps using the courts, if necessary, to help arbitrate between different views. It's a very, very serious problem, and one can only know it by really getting to know the child properly, by getting to know the parents, and maybe even saying that until you're a bit surer about it, actually a father should be prepared to live away, even when what the child is saying doesn't seem to be a very big problem, even when it only seems to be a minor problem, because in a way it would be a natural thing. And I have a recording, an audio recording that a father made when he talked to his daughter, and he said, "Look, love, you know what will happen to me if you go on saying what you're saying, that I touched you? You know that I might have to go to prison and you might have to go away." And so, you know that, love, don't you? So, I mean, did anything really happen? No, what's a child going to say in that situation? There's no way in which anybody who loves their dad, cares for their family, could say to it in a very grown-up way, "Look, Dad, I love you, but you did hurt me and I think I must say it." It's asking too much.
What we have to realise is that really it's a minefield. I think that where abuse of sexual kind takes place outside the family, that the victim there, in normal circumstances, in the majority of cases, would have a high level of support, both from the family and other professional agencies, the police, social workers and so forth. But I think that child abuse within the family is a totally different factor, because actually you've got to consider, maybe a consideration, is perhaps arresting one member of the family and the effect that that can have, the sorts of blame that that mothers may attribute to their daughters, both for the breakup of family, if that is the result, and it's not always the result, but it could be a possibility, the fact that a man may go to prison for it, and there's the subsequent loss of wages coming in, and the family's further victimised, as it were. So I think what one has to realise is that it's a very, very sensitive area, because I felt that in the past that the police had their responsibilities, the social services had their responsibilities, and there have been occasions when they've, as it were, dealt with their own without cross-referring, where perhaps we're not always aware fully of what's happened to the victim. And the idea at Bexley is that whether one agency continues the prosecution or not, there's always one to give support within the family. But what I emphasise is that the whole of the scheme is centred and focused on the victim.
We've seen recently the case of an 8-year-old who couldn't prosecute her alleged rapist because a man can't be prosecuted on the uncorroborated evidence of a child. Well, that to me is absolutely crazy. There's us running ourselves ragged, touring the country, teaching kids how to disclose and teaching people to believe those disclosures. And yet the minute we get that belief going, the courts are throwing it out because they're tied by the law. The law says we can't accept that because it's uncorroborated evidence. Yet if that child had died as a result of that abuse, there's a high probability that the man would be successfully prosecuted. So what are we saying? It's okay to go out and rape a kid as long as you don't kill her. If you kill her, we're going to prosecute you. If you rape her, you're as safe as houses. And sadly, that's true. What a sad indictment on society, isn't it?
I'd like to see some provision made to recognise the particular difficulties of children when giving evidence. I think that the removal of judges' wigs is not really sufficient. I think you've got to understand that even adults, perhaps your listeners or people who listen to the programme, the fear of going to court and give evidence, those sort of butterflies in the tummy, that sort of thing. Well, imagine that multiplied to an 8, 9, 10-year-old who's going to have to stand up in a court of law, an awesome prospect in its own, and then reiterate the most difficult and intimate of circumstances, with perhaps the defendant a matter of feet away glaring at her. Now, that's bad enough for adult victims, but I think it's especially difficult for children. And I think as long as this country decides that the arbiters of such offences are the courts, then really one must recognise the special needs of children. We do it, of course, when juveniles are defendants. That means they are, as it were, being charged and appear at juvenile court. There are very special provisions, limited number of people, very informal atmosphere. But you put that same defendant as a witness, as a victim, in a case, and there are no such protections. And I want to see that in the due course of time we recognise the special needs of children.
It's quite clear that treatment of incest in a tabloid newspaper is rubbing shoulders with all the other much more exploitative forms of sexuality that are there, and arguably much less good can come out of it.
There is not a taboo. There never has been. The taboo has been placed there by the abusers, in effect, to protect themselves and their actions. And it seems to me that the media and that the powers that be in this country are perpetuating that taboo, because it is a nasty subject to talk about. I think if people started talking about it freely and openly the way it ought to be, this problem would diminish virtually overnight.
It's only now, even very slightly, even in the courts, beginning to emerge that in fact it is a very serious and frightening problem. We do cover it up, our courts cover it up, the police cover it up, because they don't believe it. They don't believe it. Now, it's becoming clearer, and it only became clearer when violence was involved. It's very interesting that the child has to die before society begins to take notice. And when the child dies, then everyone stands up in horror. But lots of children don't die, but get damaged.
If only people would please listen, look for signs, and listen to their inside when it tells them it's right, you know. We would all like our world to be fit in a nice square box with a ribbon round. It doesn't work out that way. And when a child tells you it's been abused, please believe the child. Wouldn't tell lies. I know that for a fact. I cried out for help and nobody would listen to me.
I'm an ex-victim of incest, of sexual abuse. I'd been taught by my abuser that nobody would believe me. I'd been taught by my abuser that everybody would respond with disgust to me, so it was a waste of time me telling anybody anything. But it's totally responsible for a massive proportion of today's social ills. Deal with it properly, you'd be amazed at how many other problems you'll solve.